When Jen was 8, her father died. The last words she said to him were, "I hate you." Those words would haunt her well into adulthood as she found herself dropping out of NYU as an English major, working as a waitress for 14 years while, quote-unquote, pursuing acting and dead-end relationships, and falling deeper into depression. And then Jen went to a doctor, and the doctor prescribed antidepressants. The day she began taking them was the day she began finding her way home. Jen became a yoga teacher and a blogger. She wrote what was true, sharing all of what it means to be human. The messy, the hard, the beautiful, the magical. There was no shame, there were no apologies. Just as Jen says, real fucking life. Today, Jen is the national best-selling author of On Being Human, a memoir of waking up, living real, and listening hard. She leads sold-out yoga-related movement and writing retreats around the world and is the founder of the online magazine, The Manifest Station. Jen has been featured on Good Morning America, New York Magazine, Health Magazine, CBS News, and more. She has a massive online following and is loved the world over for her raw and real telling of what it means to be human. In this conversation, Jen shares as honestly as she does in her writing and at her retreats, talking, as always, about what it means to be human. Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn, founder of the Creativity Habit Collective, where artists and makers come together in community to get what they need so that they make what they must through intimate gatherings, circles, teaching seminars, workshops, and co-creating sessions. It's a place to form deep connections, friendship, and get all the support, love, inspiration, and courage you need to go out into the world and share all of who you are and what you make. You can learn more at thecreativityhabit.com. And you're listening to the Creativity Habit podcast. Today's guest is writer and teacher Jennifer Pasteloff. Some things that we talk about are how Jen rebuilt her entire life from depressed and unhappy to wildly successful and happier most of the time. How much to share, how to bear witness, and how to just be. Making the thing that is true to you and designing a life and business around who you are. And busting through shame, giving yourself a medal, and being free. May it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Hello, Jen, and welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Hello.
So, as most listeners, people who listen regularly know, I begin with the same question, but I gear it towards you. So the question is, how did creativity show up for you as a little girl? And in your case, I'm particularly interested in the one aspect is the writing and poetry, and another is storytelling.
I love that question. How did it show up to me as a little girl? I do think it was with writing. I started reading very, very young, and adult books. I talk about it in my book, but like Judy Blume Forever, I think, was the first book I read. And that's weird. I was like a very, very small child. But I started writing stories from the time I can remember holding a pencil. It was always with storytelling and writing. I was never someone who drew or, you know, built things. It was always words and language.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, because I heard you say, I think it was in the interview with Jonathan Fields where you talked, I'm not sure if it was though, because I don't actually have this in my notes in front of me, but it was around poetry and how poetry means so much to you. What is it that is so compelling for you around poetry in particular as a form of writing?
What is it about poetry? It's a full body reaction, the way the words hit me. It makes me feel at home in the world. It makes me feel curious. Makes me feel more alive, excited. I mean, in the same way music quite often does, and, you know, they're the same thing. But there's something about poetry that makes me feel excited to be a person. I love when certain words are strung together and how they sound on my lips when I read them out loud, or how they sound in my mind, how they land.
Have you had the experience, I'm wondering, where there are times like where you read a poem and you don't really know what it means, but it hits you anyway?
Yeah, I was actually just about to say that. I was just going to say that. Even if sometimes I don't understand it, or maybe I do, you know, maybe it's for each person to understand it, what it means to them. But even if I end the poem and I think, huh, I have no idea what that means exactly, it still can affect me profoundly, just the language or just the imagery that it created and how it made me feel. But poetry makes me feel so deeply. Good poetry. I mean, let's not just say anything.
Yeah, I mean, I get the feeling too that you just feel deeply. Like, that's who you are.
I'd like to think. I spent a long time in my life not pushing everything, not feeling deeply, pushing everything down and ignoring it and denying it. And sometimes I find myself in those patterns again. So I do things to come back, and poetry is one of them. I read poetry. I don't write it as often anymore, but reading it really brings me back to feeling.
Do you have, this is off the cuff, so if you don't, it's totally fine. Do you have any particular poem right now that's really speaking to you?
I have so many. One of my favorites is Good Bones by Maggie Smith. And she happens to be a friend of mine. I love beauty hunting, which I talk about a lot in my book. Which is the relentless pursuit of beauty, is to constantly be paying attention and looking for what's beautiful, even if it doesn't seem to be there, or even if we're in pain or grief or whatever it, you know, may be. So this poem by Maggie Smith is called Good Bones, and it goes like this. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You can make this place beautiful. I just love it.
Oh,
you
my
can make
gosh.
This, yeah, that sentiment. You can make this place beautiful. I love that sentiment, you know, how it's up to us.
Yeah.
To yeah. find it.
I'm just taking it
another,
back for a second. Yeah, go
I
on.
I have so many. I know you opened up this portal, but, and another one, another friend of mine, I have her hanging on my wall here, Naomi Shihab Nye, the poem Kindness. I won't read the whole thing, but There's some lines in it that say, before you know kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread. So yeah, there's so many. There's so many. You know, there are words that make you go, yes, yes, yes.
Yes. There's a poem, and I don't have it in front of me, and I don't remember it. And it's interesting because when I was in college, I read it, and I didn't understand it necessarily, but it moved me so deeply. I wrote it on the back of my notebook and carried it around with me for the 4 years. And all that I remember of it now is when I was young, I used to speak of sorrow, but now, having tasted sorrow, I say instead, cool day, lovely fall.
Oh, I've heard that. I love that. I can't remember
Yeah.
who wrote it.
So I want to actually take that because one of the things that you said actually very early on in On Being Human is you say, when I finally got out the tools to build what I thought I needed for the life I wanted, I realized that what I needed was within me, but first I had to rebuild everything. And I think about that in terms of creating beauty, in terms of making the world that we're in individually and collectively beautiful, this idea of rebuilding everything. And why, first of all, did you have this need, this knowing that you had to rebuild everything?
That's so, I love that part of the book because I remember exactly where I was when I wrote it. And I was with Lydia Yuchnovich, who wrote the foreword to my book. And it was from a prompt she gave, which was something about you're building something and these are the tools. And it just started to come from there. But that's where I had the epiphany that I had rebuilt my life, so I was writing about it in past tense, because the way I was living my life was not working. I mean, it was working in the effect that I was still alive, but I was miserable and I hated myself and I wasn't being creative. And so I rebuilt my life from the inside out. And so when I was writing from that prompt, I that's when I realized it. Her exercise, it was an exercise in creativity and your imagination, and it was about tools. What tools do you need? And you're going to build something. And it just came out, but I realized, oh, I rebuilt my life, and I had to. But what I really mean is I rebuilt my relationship with myself. And the way that I talk to myself and everything else fell into place. The way I thought of myself, what I thought was possible.
I know in another place you say the will to grow must outweigh the need to feel safe. You have to want it badly enough. Where did that come from within you to begin and then keep rebuilding yourself? Because that's a massive renovation that took place.
Yeah, so that line came, and I also remember exactly where I was. I was in my bed when I wrote that years ago, maybe even 8 years ago, I don't know. But I found this old journal. I don't remember if I say this in the book, but I found this old journal when I was in sixth grade. Our teacher used to have us write journals and turn them in for a grade, which is so bizarre. But so it wasn't this authentic journal. It was more, just like words. But in it, so I was looking at it this night, however many years ago it was, and I got kind of depressed and I threw it across the room because I opened it and I thought, oh, this is so pathetic. I haven't changed. I'm literally the same person I was when I was 12, because in it I was, complaining and I was saying I'm tired and it just sounded like me still. And I really did. I had this like panic attack and I thought, oh my God, like, what's the point even? No one changes. I mean, I'm the same person I was at 12. And what's the point of anything? And then though, so I threw the journal, this little silly notebook. But then I thought, wait a minute, I have changed. That's bullshit. I absolutely have. No, I still sometimes get stuck in that I'm tired track and, various things, but I absolutely have. I was wanting to die, so depressed at that restaurant, thinking that I wasn't worth anything, that I couldn't do anything. And then at, by this point, when I had this epiphany, I was already, teaching yoga and leading workshops. And I thought, I did this. I absolutely did this. I did change. So I picked the journal up and put it back in my drawer. And I thought, well, that's possible. And so then I started thinking about my father, who was a drug addict. And the story goes that he was warned about very shortly before he died, like, if you do drugs again, you'll die. And he did, and he died. And my cousin, which I didn't write about in the book, because it's not my story to tell, same exact age as me, 10 years ago, she OD'd from heroin. It was the same thing. And I thought, oh, so like the doing the drugs or whatever it is that keeps you safe. And for me, the staying at the restaurant, even though I was miserable, there was such a safety in that, in the way I'd been for so long. It was what I knew. It was the safe, complacent way to be. Then I blew everything up. The will to grow finally outweighed that feeling of like, I have to stay the same. I have to stay safe. I can't make any kind of change.
Okay, so there's a couple of things there. The first thing is that importance of noticing, like in that moment after you threw the journal across the room, it was like, God, I'm the same person I was when I was 12. And then, no, I'm not. That the power in acknowledging the no, I'm not, like this is how I've changed. How important is that on this journey of change?
Thank you for saying that, because I'm a huge advocate of that. You know, and all the time now, you know, people will say, you must be so proud of yourself for writing this book. I absolutely am. Absolutely. You know, it's this acknowledging, I end the book on this, give yourself a fucking medal. It's this acknowledging ourselves, not just the stuff that we don't like about ourselves, but the ways in which we've grown, the ways in which we've changed, what's beautiful about ourselves.
It's amazing, isn't it? Like someone that we can so easily go to the place of, oh, I'm so fucked up, and everyone will be like, oh God, isn't it terrible? But if we walk into a room and say, I'm so amazing, we'll be like, what's wrong with you?
I know. I think about that all the time. It's so funny. It's really just an interesting thing. So, you know, the answer to me is to walk in a room and you don't necessarily have to say, I'm so amazing, but you are that. You know, I wake up in the morning and I say in my head, I say, hey, may I have the courage to be who I say I am? And then, so therefore, if I'm like, yes, I am powerful, or I'm amazing, or I'm love, then let me walk through the world as that. I don't have to say it, but if I embody that, and let me tell you something, and I say this all the time in my workshops. Now in my 40s, I'm way more desirable. I'm way more attractive. Way more people want me, look at me, whatever you want to call it. And it has nothing to do with what I look like. It is because I exude that. It is because I no longer hate myself. It's because I love myself. And some days I don't like myself, let's be clear. But, you know, I'm human. But I walk in and that energy is so contagious, you know?
Love that. Okay, there's a couple things. So I have to go back. I want to stay with one thing you said, and then I want to come back to this thing about let me have the courage to be who I say I am. So note that. One of the things that you were saying earlier, though, was how 13 and a half years you're in this restaurant, 13 and a half years you're working there, even though you hate it, you hate yourself, but it's safe. And then at some point, the desire to change grew more powerful than the desire to stay safe. And I know this is every person's journey. Like each person will have to figure out for themselves when they cross that line. And having said that, it's funny to go into advice, but you can either offer it as advice or you can offer it as a personal story, however you want. How do we begin to free ourselves from that intense longing to be safe when we want to do and be more?
I don't know. And it's a personal thing for each person, and it's varying degrees of safety. You know, being safe is good. My husband makes me feel really safe, and that's really important to me. Having lost my father at 8, and my biggest thing is feeling unsafe in the world. So I chose someone that makes me feel safe. I don't judge myself for it at all. So it is finding our own personal boundaries of where is this keeping myself safe, keeping me stuck? Is it making me miserable? Is it self-care? But you know, for me, so that the will to grow must outweigh the need to stay safe. Now, I had this epiphany just now while I was in the kitchen pouring coffee, muting you so you wouldn't hear, and which was, for me, the will to grow started, you know, slowly. When I started doing yoga, I started dating my husband, which was a really big deal because he was kind and he wanted to be with me. And I was not used to that. And I'm so grateful that I allowed myself to allow him in, because I could still, at this point in my life, be with someone who made me feel worthless, you know. So, but the real moment came when I went and took antidepressants. Am I suggesting everybody take them? No way. But for me, that was the thing. I was so stuck and so miserable, and nothing was working until I went on meds. And it wasn't this, you know, huge life-altering shift. It was the tiniest thing that just said, huh, maybe I'll do a yoga. Maybe I will do that yoga teacher training. So it was like I had a cloud over my eyes of darkness, and now I didn't. And, you know, and that one little now what, which isn't so little, led to another. So, you know, not to spoil the book, but I end the book on the words now what. And that doesn't spoil the book.
No, listeners. Nothing can spoil
listeners,
the book.
Listeners.
No.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But, I really do think asking, now what? And it's the little things. It's the little things.
Yeah.
So I didn't blow up my whole life. It wasn't like one day I woke up and I was like, fuck this restaurant. I threw my apron and I, you know, and I gave everyone the finger and I walked out. And then, you know, now here I am and I'm famous. And no. It's 10 years later since I've left that restaurant. I'm still in the same one-bedroom apartment. Yes, I'm wildly successful. Does that mean I'm rich? No. Does that mean it was little by little? Yes. In some ways, it feels like it was overnight. To some people who may not know me, it may seem like that. But it was one now what after the other.
That is so great. It's so great because even I see, like, the way I ask the question is this big, and I tend to ask questions this way anyway, but this big, wide open how, and then you made it nice and small and said, you don't have to see the big how, you just do the next now what.
Right. And also something that's come in my glorious 40s, I'm so abso-fucking-lutely okay with saying, I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know.
It's
and,
the best.
And with, yeah, and without a moment of like, I should know this. Nope. Without a moment of I'm going to be judged. Just completely, I don't know. And that's what's so beautiful about being human is it's all about the asking of the questions. It's all about the figuring it out. It's all about the diving in and the paying attention.
Oh my gosh. So I have to... Okay, stay tethered here. So,
no, but see, this is what I like. This excites me. You see, when you get excited, this is how I get with you know, when you ask me about poetry, how you and I are getting right now. Like, I stood up and now I'm pacing my apartment and I'm all, yes, it's that feeling of, to sound cliche, aliveness.
Okay, so what is it for you right now that has you feeling so alive?
Connection. It always keeps coming back to connection. I will say, you know, I've been, let's see, the past almost 3.5 months, I've been going nonstop, literally on an airplane on book tour, and meeting all these people around the country who have read my book and share their stories with me. It has been the most moving experience that I can remember. I mean, I've had a lot of moving experiences working with all these women who've lost children. You know, I do all these things that are, you know, sometimes I think, how is this even possible? This is so beautiful and moving and hard and sad and deep and joyful or whatever it is, but full. But since I've been on book tour, really connecting with people, because it's still hard to believe that anyone read the book, you know, just that my mom just read it, you know, or my agent or whatever, you know, it's still, there's still moments where I feel utterly disconnected, where someone posts it or something on Instagram and I think, well, that's not my book, or that, I mean, they didn't really read it, you know. It's so when I talk to someone and their eyes are welled up, or they grab my hand, or they, whatever it is, connection, it always comes down to connection. Yeah. Getting to do this work that I do in the world for a living, which I love so, so, so much, getting to do it as my job.
Yeah. I want to talk about this idea of connection and stories, because you're a storyteller. You, On Being Human, is all stories and very human stories. And some of them are really sad, some of them are not, and they're all beautiful. And the question I have with that is, what I see in myself and what I see with a lot of other people that I work with is this confusion around the telling of stories, because there's this thing that happens when we start to tell a story, and it will often be followed by, oh my gosh, I'm not usually this vulnerable, or I'm sorry for being so vulnerable. And an apology, right? Like,
I mean, not that doesn't happen with me anymore, because it's what I do for a living, and so it's so on my radar. So, but that's by far the thing I hear the most.
I want to talk about that, because I find that so curious, that us, that sharing what it means to be human, even though every one of us is human, so every one of us understands what it means to be human, that it feels vulnerable to share that. What is that? Because I feel like if we don't understand that, we may not feel so inspired to tell our story. I'm not sure. This is something I'm trying to figure out.
I think about this a lot. And, you know, something that really beautiful has begun to happen. And I was thinking about this morning when I was teaching yoga. I still teach 2 hours a week, about who I let into my life. But the people that are in my, you know, inner circle and even my online inner circle, let's call it, all are really open and vulnerable, and I've planned it that way. I think it boils down to shame and how many of us are raised just to kind of suck it up. And you know, I know culturally, my husband, we're so different. He was raised he's half Iranian and half British, and just very different culturally. It doesn't express himself in the same way I do, and it's uncomfortable for him, and not so much for me. Granted, I do this for a living, but even in general, I grew up in a much different environment. Jewish, and talk with my hands, and we talk about how we feel. you know, so I think people perceive it as a weakness, and they do, and they feel ashamed for some reason. And yet there's nothing more beautiful to me than someone being utterly themselves. Now, that doesn't mean, and I say this every workshop, and I will for the rest of my life, that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm saying, oh, you should walk down the street weeping and telling everyone everything, because that's right. A whole other thing. You know, and not everyone deserves to hear our story or to have our attention or our vulnerability. But Brené Brown says, she says something like, shame can't survive. Is it with vulnerability? I can't remember, but this idea that where shame can't survive. And so, you know, one of the things I work on all the time is busting myths around shame and coming into understanding of why we carry the shame and how we don't need to anymore.
Do you think that... Oh, gone.
No, I was just going to say, a mantra I use sometimes is shame has no place in my body. It'll try to... My inner asshole will try to tell me it does. Another thing Brené Brown says that I love is, you know, shame is... What is... Shame is I am bad. Guilt is I did something bad. And that... I cried when I heard that because... When you read in my book, you know, I said, I hate you to my dad and he died. And so immediately I am a bad person was my refrain. And I still struggle with that. It's very old wiring. And so it's there to taunt me. So when I heard that, I thought, oh my gosh, like I was so ashamed that I made my father die and it was my fault and I'm a bad person and my whole life. And you know, as kids, when we start to make these decisions about ourselves, it's so easy. It was eight. What did I know?
Exactly. And, yeah, so. And then they run the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And okay, that was the thing. So you started to say about walking down the street. It doesn't mean we're going to walk down the street and be weeping and share our story with everybody. And one of the questions I hear probably the most often in terms of sharing is, well, but how much do I share? And when is it too much? And I, again, that's a very personal decision. And I think it's curious that this question is the one I hear the most. So you, as someone who shares for a living, where have you found that balance? How have you decided how much you share or don't share?
I do think it's a deeply personal question. I don't know, you know, what it means exactly. So if, for example, you're with someone and you're paying attention and you're paying attention to the conversation or how it's going or what they seem capable of holding, then I think your instinct and your gut and your body will tell you. And it's all a personal thing. I mean, if we stop worrying about one of the reasons people don't, I think, want to share so much is because they think, you know, for example, I work with people, a lot of people who've lost children, and they're afraid to upset the other person.
To accept the other person?
Upset the other person.
Oh, upset.
Yeah.
Upset.
Yeah, yeah. That's so, I see that all the time. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. Or whatever it is, or someone's dealing with a hard time. I'm sorry to bring you down. I'm sorry to bring you down. I'm sorry to depress you. I'm sorry to scare you. I know it's a lot. I, you know, and there's this like constant, I'm going to mess you up. So, mm-hmm. But if you're really paying attention, you're with someone who, like, I have a tattoo now, says I got you, and you're really paying attention, then you share until it feels right. You have to get out of your own way, which is that fear of they're not going to be able to handle it. Now, granted, some people can't, and that's why I teach people and I work on bearing witness and learning how to not look away and learning how to just be.
And to notice that in others.
Yes. So. Well, that's why, you know, I do a lot of work around grief and, you know, I have a retreat coming up next week. I don't even know what day it is. And, in Italy, and I bring women who've lost children and have gone through other, one woman just signed up the other day. Her husband just died of a brain tumor and at 40. And, so we sit with these people and they're mixed in with the others. I say others because, you know, we're all human, but others who aren't experiencing these profoundly deep, impossible things, but we learn how to be with that.
Mm.
It's amazing. It really is the greatest gift. Mm. And then the other thing about how much to share is I also use this as a gauge. How much is my story? So yeah, I mean, in the book, there are lots of things I left out. My sister, my mom, my cousin, my husband, because it wasn't my story to tell. So there's that. There's letting go of shame and letting go of the fear of what will they think.
Okay, so then this is the other question I wanted to ask you around that, because as a teacher, okay, you said in the book, you said, it dawned on me that the part of them, you're talking about workshop participants, The part of them I was smitten with was the side they probably tried to hide, just as I had done with my own vulnerability or perceived weaknesses. So then what I wanted to ask was, here you are as a teacher, and there's many examples in the book where you talk about things that happened right before you were about to lead a yoga retreat or right before you're about to host some kind of workshop where mm-hmm. you're not in a great space, and you get up and you share that as part of your teaching. Yep. And so the question I wondered about is, like, we look to teachers to some degree to have it together so that we can feel like, oh, we're safe. Like, here's this person who has it together. So there's some place in the world that I'll go where I can find people who have it together. If a teacher shares the mess and the not so messy parts, do you find that that actually has people feel even more safe? Or is like, what happens when we share all of that and we're in this role of teacher?
Another great question. I can speak from my experience. For me, it has had people feel more safe, and it's working for me. My stuff was sold out a year in advance, so I can only speak to that. And I'm sure there's some people that come that I'm not their cup of tea. Nope, I need someone that's more guru-like or whatever they're looking for, right? What I found is I'm not interested in that. And I don't also... I do think, yes, I'm facilitating, I'm leading, but they're teaching me just as much. And I don't say that to sound corny. It's really the absolute truth. I'm just on this journey. I never pretend that I know any more than anyone else. I just share my story. This is what happened to me. This is how I'm processing it. So I learn by going through it and teaching it as I'm going through it. And that's my way. I remember, I think it was 2014 when I broke my foot and I was off my antidepressants and I was really struggling. And I flat out told the room at the time. And I remember it really felt like my shoulders dropped down. I thought I was going to cry just with the relief. You know, again, that thing happened where, and I made a video. I remember I was at the retreat and I went out and I made this video called, there's a TV show on Netflix called The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. And I don't know why. I must have been binging it. I called it Unbreakable Jenny Pastel. And I know, it's really cornballish. And I just made this really bare bones video just saying I'm off my meds. And I got hundreds and hundreds of emails and calls and texts and of thank you, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And then, you know, look, when Robin Williams died by suicide, you know, some people, people like that in the public eye who seem to be have it all. I keep coming back to how important it is that I share that if you're in a position, and that's what works for me.
Yeah.
If you're in a position to, and I think, you know, that's one of my superpowers. My superpower is connecting with people. So that's how I'm going to use it.
I say this all the time, whether it's with guests on the podcast or to other creatives, like, God, the more we can share these stories, the more free we will be, because we look to these people who, quote unquote, have it all and think that somehow those stories aren't part of their universe. But they are, because we're human. And so to know that allows us to feel so much freer in our journey and less guilt and less shame and less like a
right.
film. Yeah.
So why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't we? I don't understand that other... that's not to say I share every single thing with you, I'm sure. But, you know, if I'm nervous, I tell people. I walk in, I go, how many people are afraid? I ask the workshop, you know, I had an 80% raise their hand. I go, me too. And I'm serious.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't I say that? Phew, I'm nervous. I've never been in this particular room with these particular people, but I'm here anyway. You know, and the more honest I can be, I've had this profound hearing loss, and it's just been so bad lately. I've been feeling so sorry for myself because it's just getting worse. And when I don't have my hearing aids in, I can't hear, and the tinnitus is so loud, which is the ringing in my ears. And now I'm so open about it, but there was a time I wasn't, and I would just struggle with pretending I was hearing people. So right off the bat, I'm like, hey, I'm deaf. And hey, the, you know, and it's like, okay, I'm a human being. How refreshing is that? And it also, you know, I did this post on Instagram the other day that went viral. People went bananas for it. And it was my kitchen. It was my kitchen, which is like,
oh yeah, I saw that.
As big as the size of like my hand, literally. And I did this post, you know, just like my whole book is about, you can be more than one thing, right? So you can struggle with depression and be inspiring. You can be successful and live in a small apartment. So I shared this post about, you know, just this honest, this is how I live. And I don't know. I think it reminds people that, oh, you don't have to look a certain way to be successful or live a certain way to be successful or hide who you are. It's just, I think it's really important.
Well, that ties into something that you said earlier that I wanted to come back to, which is when you said, I'm not interested in that. Like when you said, you know, this is how I do my retreats because that's what I'm interested in. This is how I want to do it. And I think that is really important to underline, the idea that if that's, it doesn't matter if there are other people out there who want the teacher who has it all together, that's not what you're interested in. And just the reminder that you are creating your own game. It's your choice how you want to play.
Absolutely. And you know what? It wasn't always this way. This confidence is newfound in the last few years. I mean, it wasn't like I woke up one morning and it was gradual. And now it really is. I'm A-okay with who I am, how I do things. If you want something different, great. It's out there for you. I do my best to, you know, for example, my retreats around the world in Italy or France, and God bless my sweet mom. She helps. And we try to sort of figure out if the person's right, and usually they are, meaning like we ask, why do you want to come or why are you interested? Now, if someone said, well, I want to lose weight, or I want to, you know, I really just want to tour Italy, or I want to learn how to do chaturanga and handstands, and okay, well, I will direct them to some of my other friends that do this. So, but it took a while where I would before, and I talked about this in the book, I just wanted anyone. I just need bodies because I need to survive. I need to pay rent. And now it's like, this is what I do. This is who I am. This is what I offer. I can't say exactly what it's going to be like because it's always determined by who is in the room. But I'm not wavering in who I am. May I have the courage to be who I say I am.
Has that changed when you say, I'm not wavering, this is who I am? Has that changed in terms of how people respond to your work?
Yes, because I it's like I said earlier, I think people respond when you're confident, you believe in yourself and you love yourself. People recognize that and they go, I want a piece of that. I want, you know. You know, the same people come, but it does seem that I haven't had any, now that I say it, watch, let me touch some wood here. You know, I haven't had anyone that's like I wrote about in the book, the girl who came who you know, said, I need yoga. This isn't yoga. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had that. And I hope I never have that again. Or sometimes, you know, someone comes and they have their armor on, as I call it, or they have an expectation, but then by like a day they've softened and they don't even remember what they thought they wanted. Although
even with the woman who says, I came for yoga and I need yoga, so I'm leaving. I mean, that led to this huge epiphany for you. So there was gold in that too. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a gift, but let's be honest. It's a gift now. Maybe it was a gift a year later. It wasn't a gift when it happened. It felt like shit, mm-hmm. You know? So that's another thing that I want to always be really honest about is like acknowledging the feelings. Oh, that hurt. And yes, I took it personally. And yes, I obsessed. And, you know, maybe it took a couple days before I was okay with it. But I was like spinning down a rabbit hole. You know, when I broke my foot, it wasn't a gift right then. I can look back now and see all the gifts in it. But it was absolutely, the epiphany came that no one's going to give me a medal. And here's the and. I still take things personally. So if someone comes and there's a lot of resistance, or they walk out, or they slam their notebook down and leave, you know, this hasn't happened, but will I get a little thrown? Maybe. But I'm not going to change what I do or who I am so that I get more bodies, or that so people will like me more, or I'll fit in, you know, in whatever, be more yoga or be more of a literary person. It's like, you know what? I don't fit inside a box, and I'm not going to. So you can join me out here or find a different box.
But do you think it's easier for you to say that and embody that with knowing, like, yeah, the world, there's a big world out there that knows who I am. And so this, I can stand in that, and my retreats sell out a year in advance, and this is who I am, versus, wow, I'm trying to pay rent and I'm trying to get by. And it's really scary for me to say, given that this is who I am. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's funny. I'm just smiling because I just asked my friend that. I've been coaching people, and my friend who I used to wait tables with, it's just such a beautiful journey. He's a life coach now, and so he's coaching me. And I said, you know, I have such this confidence now. I told him about the kitchen post, and sometimes I did a post in my underwear, and my bathroom looked ridiculous. And it was another one of those viral posts, because things I didn't even notice. You know, there's bleach on my towel. People are like, thank you for showing that. And I said to him, I said, I wonder if I would feel as emboldened, is that the right word? If I wasn't getting so many likes and so much validation. And I said, that's a really honest thing to admit, and it's kind of gross. And he said, you know what, Jen, you're human. So I said, yeah. And the truth is, of course that makes me feel more confident in this, you know, there's like this little validation that goes, yeah, keep going. Yeah, you're on the right path. And I say this exact line in the book. I do see the danger in that too. So I don't, you know, I don't pay attention too much to comments and all that, because I don't want it to get me misaligned, you know, to start paying attention to like what they like, what they don't like. But I think that is a human response, is like, if you do something and it seems to be working, you get more confident in what you're doing.
Yeah. And I ask that in part because it's really easy to beat ourselves up when we're starting out and feel like, oh great, I say who I am and nobody seems to care, or I'm too scared to say this is who I am. And to just, that's also a process.
And also, you know, I'm obsessed with this idea of and I'm also always afraid. You know, and I'm always scared, and I do it anyway. So the thing I think about a lot is all those years when I was at the newsroom, that was the name in the restaurant, I was always afraid, and I never did anything. And now I'm afraid, but I do the things. So, you know, I mean, I'm embarking on this journey tomorrow, and I'm going to be gone basically for 1 month. I'm coming home for 24 hours all the way from Italy to see my son, and then flying back to Philly. But like, I'm terrified, you know, and not just of one thing, but I'm going to get on that plane tomorrow. I'm going to pack my bag when we hang up, and I'm going to get on the plane.
What's terrifying about it?
Being away from my son for that long, staying present. You know, I have a workshop on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I have an event, Tuesday, I have another event, you know, just staying here, authentic in my body, not getting burnt out, not getting sick, having a place my own, staying on my friend's sofa in New York, you know, I mean, just some of it's ridiculous. Doing a thing in Brooklyn on Monday night with some, you know, big writers. I don't measure up. I'm not a real writer. Oh, I'm afraid of that. You know, I'm doing a thing in Philly on Tuesday with Jennifer Weiner, very famous author. She wrote In Her Shoes and Good in Bed. You know, just the old inner asshole stuff, like coming in at me, doing a workshop with Elizabeth Gilbert in Philly. So there's just a lot of expansion and growth and big things happening, and I'm stepping into it.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about that idea of the and, because that's something that you talk a lot about on Being Human, and it's something, and I had written it down because I really liked it. You said, "I would marvel that I could be two things at once, wholly unafraid and utterly terrified, exposed and safe, deaf and listening. How remarkable that my heart could be out in the world, helping me to listen when my ears failed me, and also be safely nestled inside my body." So this idea of and, as you just said, is really important to you. And there's something there that is, again, feels so powerful about we want I'll speak for myself, like I want things to be a lot of times black and white, that it's this or it's this. And then it's like, well, actually it can be and.
I know. And I think it's a lesson of my life, and I still forget it. I still forget it. So I work on reminding myself every day. All of us, it's what it means to be human, which again, I know I keep coming back to these women who've lost children, but they've just taught me so much. So we're in this retreat let's say 1 year ago when I was in Italy with 5 people I brought on scholarship. And there was deep grief, but there was so much joy and laughter and dance parties and ridiculous Rick Astley flash mob and staying up all night. And it's like, wow, look what's possible in the midst of grief. Mm. How did that?
Yeah. And that's a good example too of dropping whatever shame and guilt, right? Because a lot of times we have this idea of what even grief is supposed to look and feel like.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember my friend Emily Ratblack lost her son a few years ago from Tay-Sachs, and there was a lot of that, you know, like you're not grieving the right way. Doesn't look like you're sad, you know, just so the idea of and is really important to me, especially because, you know, my next book I want to write is called Should as an Asshole, because everything about my life doesn't look like a quote unquote traditional nor normal life. You know, what's that?
Yeah. What is that?
I don't know, but it's the thing I used to think everyone else had.
I think it's funny because I just posted and it's a quote that people know. It's essentially speaking to what you're saying right now, which is this quote by Joseph Campbell. If you can see your path laid out in front of you step by step, you know it's not your path. Your own path you make with every step you take. That's why it's your path.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, that's what you're doing, and that's what you're offering every one of us. I mean, that's the beauty of this. That's the beauty of every story you share. It's the beauty of the way you choose to lead workshops. It's the beauty of you getting up in front of the class, in front of the retreat and saying, hey, this is what happens. I'm off my antidepressants, blah, 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 blah. Is that, look, you get to walk your path in the way you want to walk it. It's your path.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get a little bit into this process of the writing, and just it's one thing to post on Facebook and to post on Instagram and put our stuff out there. It's another thing to create this very disciplined practice of writing a book. And I don't mean discipline in the way like, oh, it's every day from this time to this time, just discipline from I start and I go until it's finished. And
yep. I know exactly what you mean, because I'm never going to be that everyday person. So it is really different. But I had to trick myself for most of it and pretend that I was just doing a post or something so that I could actually get it done. So okay. I didn't get it in my head about what it should sound like. This is a book. This needs to sound like this.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, is like how you keep going with that. So it sounds like one piece is tricking yourself into not buying into the story of this is what it should be.
Another one, asking for help. I had help. I had a great team. I had help. I had friends. I had support. And, you know, it was my first book, so I still don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I will on a second or third. But my friend Emily Ratblack helped me a lot. And so for me, asking for help and being open to receiving it just even having just someone read it and feedback, you know, I'd never written a book. So ending chapters, this was so foreign to me. How to end a chapter, how to start one, you know, this linear story, which it is in a way, you know, tricking myself that, and then because I said I would, and I signed a contract, so I had to do it. So there wasn't any more just, I don't feel like it. Okay, well, you signed a contract, you got paid good money, it's due, first draft is due in May, it's now October, get to work. You don't have a choice. Well, I mean, I did, but then I, you know. And the people I surround myself with who kept reminding me, you can do this. You can do this.
So breaking it down, making it something, doing it in a way that worked for you as opposed to the way that you're someone supposedly writes a book, getting the help, knowing that you just had to do it, and then reminding yourself that you can. Those were the big ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, like, so some of the time I went and I would fly to Portland because that's where I do workshops with Lydia, and I'd stay in this hotel there, and it was really conducive to writing, and it was just kind of, you know, Portland, I don't know, there's something about it that feels writerly. And so I would go there, I went there twice for like a week and locked myself in the hotel room, and so I did what I had to do. But I say the tricking myself and then asking for help.
We have a funny thing about that, don't we? Like asking for help. There's something that...
Right. It's the same thing as the vulnerability of the questions you're asking me earlier.
Yes.
Why don't we share our stories? And I mean, this is why I'm so okay with saying, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. Would you help me? And sometimes that requires money. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I would like to go into that one story, actually, because you share that in two different places, I think, when with your hearing aids, crowdsourcing or crowdfunding for hearing aids. And the first time it was friends, other people who did it for you. And it was the only way that you were able to get hearing aids. And at this point, you're leading retreats, you're hosting workshops, and I think it was maybe that time or it was the second time when someone had texted you and said, well, are you sure you want to do this? Because think of how poorly this will
be. It's about your brand or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So again, there's this having to, it's the and, right? Like you're holding the idea of, yeah, I have a brand. I have, this is who Jen Pasteloff is. And then there's, and I need the money in order to have the hearing aids. And so there's both.
Well, I'll take it one step further.
Great.
My friend, I have this really good friend named Shauna Mann, and she's for years, she's been saying, Jen, your brand is truth. And then I was, oh my God, I love that. But you know, I have this hashtag I made up, which is why I post the kitchen and whatnot, and it's real motherfucking life. That's my brand. Nobody said that except one person, right? Maybe you shouldn't do this GoFundMe because it's bad for your brand or your image or whatever it was she said. One person, everyone else was sharing it and donating it and supporting. And of course, you know, for 5 minutes, I listened to one person and I felt ashamed. And then I remembered. I thought, no, my brand is telling the truth. My brand is real life. I've created no other brand besides that. You tell me, what is my brand besides that? There isn't. That's all I do. Just being human, just telling the truth about who I am and what it means to be me in the world. So why wouldn't I?
It's so great. Okay, so then here's the other thing I wanted to ask about that, because another thing you speak to is this idea of just, you know, be you. There's plenty of space out there, even though it feels really crowded, there's plenty of space. And yet I speak with people all the time who are like, I'm making my art, I'm sharing my thing, I'm doing my creative whatever. And it doesn't feel like there's plenty of space. I'm finding it really hard to get noticed. I'm finding it hard to sell my stuff. And so there's this one story that says, just make it. And if you make who you are, if you give who you are, it will work. And then there's all these other people going, I'm doing that and it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your response to that?
Well, you know, it's true. And I do think that it's, we have to redefine sometimes what it means to be working or successful. So yes, sometimes like I have friends that are actors and they're not getting any work and it's really frustrating. So I don't abide to things I used to say a really long time ago when I first started doing this work. I, you know, worshiped Wayne Dyer. I still do. May he rest in peace. But I mimicked a lot of what he says. He was my teacher. And then over the years, I thought, oh, I don't know if I actually stand by that anymore. For example, I used to always say, I would just chant this because he said it, I can manifest anything I put my attention on. Now, I don't really believe that anymore. So it's tricky. I think one of the things that we have to do is really become clear on what it is we say we want. So for me, one of the things with my book was like the New York Times bestseller. I was like, but what is that really? And then I go deeper. I go, okay, well, that really is security. And it's, you know, it was all about like, it comes back to the safety thing. So when we start to come back to what we really want, quite often we go, oh, well, actually, I do have that. Now, if we're talking about, you know, making art and becoming rich on it, well, if that's your goal, I don't know what to tell you. It may happen by accident. God bless you if it does. But it's certainly, I really don't know what to say to people that are going into something with the intention just to make money. Because it's, you know, it's totally possible, but I believe we have to do it because we want to create, or we have no choice. You had to write the book because you had to, or because it's the only thing that makes you feel alive, or because you love it or whatever it is. But I don't know. And then also there's this, which is a sucky thing to say, and it's also the truest thing I could say. Life isn't fair. And it's a hard pill to swallow, and I struggle with it all the time. And that was a refrain of mine when my dad died and when my nephew got diagnosed with Prader-Willi. It's like, life isn't fair. And it's not. But accepting that, it's like things aren't on a level playing field. And yes, sometimes you see someone who got a book deal for like $1 million and you think their book stinks and doesn't make any sense. And I know, I know, and keep going. Yeah. You know, I say all the time, keep going or shut down. Those are only two options. So what are you going to choose? And it's okay if you stop at one point. Like if my friends who are actors who aren't booking jobs, if they finally go, I'm tired actually. And I do love acting, but this isn't working. So now what? And you get to change your mind, right? So my son the other day was the cutest thing. He asked me, he begged me to buy him this cheese at Trader Joe's. These little, you know, round red balls are like in wax and you peel it. And I gave him one the other day and he said, Mommy, I don't want this. I don't like this. And I said, you begged me to buy this. And he looked at me and he goes, I'm changing my mind. And I said, what did you just say? What? I was like, that's great. I high-fived him. I took the cheese back. And I said, where did you learn that? And he goes, Mommy. Oh, my God. I was really proud. But you get to change your mind. But I think the only choice, if you're an artist, if you're someone who really wants to create, is to just keep creating.
Yeah.
And the more we can release attachment to the outcome, always the better we'll be. Always. Without fail.
I love like every moment where there's just that reminder of, right, it's going back, it's the black and white thinking versus the and. You can keep making art. You can keep creating. Or you can shut down. And if you decide that this isn't working this way, then maybe it's this way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The last thing I want to say about that is I said, you know, releasing attachment to outcome. And that's not easy. I said it three times because it's, you know, something I work on every single day. It's not easy. So I'm not throwing that out there like, just let go, just release from detach yourself from the outcome. Oh, okay, you write a book or you spend your life making a film or whatever and then have it come out and it tanks or it doesn't make any money or whatever. And then you know, it's hard, but you keep going.
That's right. It's hard, you keep going, and then you decide what stories you make from it. Like, so this is where the bullshit stories come in. This is one way that it comes in, is like, what are the stories that we then choose to believe about it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That was, okay, so there's something, this is a big part of your teaching, and you can go into it whatever you want. I want to ask a particular thing around it, which is, you say, most people will believe the bullshit stories we put forth. How careful we should be with what we convince people of about ourselves. So the thing that I wonder about in that is, when we believe the story and we put it out there, people believe it, in the same way that you being in the space of feeling really confident of, can I be the person that I say that I am, and being love and being truth, and people are drawn to that because you are that, because that's the story you now believe. And so we believe the stories that other people tell us to believe about themselves. And if we decide to tell different stories, because like in the thing you say, how careful we should be that what we convince people of about ourselves with what we convince people of. But what if we want to be telling someone a different story, but we don't believe it about ourselves yet?
Well, one of the things I do, and I encourage you to do, and people, is to just pay radical attention to who you're surrounding yourself with, so that you're, you know, looking into the eyes of someone who sees you as you really are and reminds you in a loving way. So you don't get to carry your bullshit story. So you know, I have these amazing people in my life that constantly remind me who I am. So important. I don't know where I'd be without my friends and my friendships and these reminders. And so that there are people who are in abusive relationships or just don't have that. And I encourage them to get out and to find that. And it's okay if you don't fully believe it about yourself. It's a process, which is why I talk about mantras and changing your mind's tattoo and creating prayer and putting it in your body and walking through the world with that. And, you know, because it's a day-to-day thing. And also, coming back to the day-to-day thing, you know, you can wake up one day. I woke up the other day and I felt on top of the world. I can't even explain how good I felt and powerful. And, you know, I'm going to get all this done. And then the next day I woke up and I felt so off kilter and sad and self-conscious. And okay, that doesn't make sense. Yesterday, you know, and it's a day-to-day thing. So yeah. If you asked me yesterday, you know, if whatever day that was, I was so confident, the next day I wasn't. So it's a day-to-day thing. So it's, to me, it's actually breath by breath. And it's making the choice to rewire. And, you know, it's a slew of things. Who am I surrounding myself? What am I saying to myself? What am I doing to create? It's like saying that this is what it's like saying to me, that you can't love unless you know how to love yourself first. Now, there's some truth to that, but if you're in the process of learning how to love yourself, yes, you can damn well love someone else.
That's true. This is another thing that comes up a lot. So when we talked about making, and you make because you have to, or you make because it's how you feel the most alive. And then there's this component, which if we have, whether it's a business or not, there's the component of then sharing it with the world. And I know, like you talked about when you first shared really honestly on Facebook, you felt like you were going to throw up, but you did it anyway. And then what happens when you do something like that and you get the validation and how it encourages you to keep going. So at some point you said, we all need an audience, whether it's one person or 1 million, we must feel heard to thrive. If we're putting our stuff out and we feel like it's just nobody's really hearing it, is the next thing then, okay, well, I just need to do whatever I need to do to find the people that will hear me. It's like there.
Yes. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I'm clear again, it can be one, it can be 1 million. Now, I talk about this in the book, but I had this boyfriend, I was told this story in the book, but I would say, can I read you a poem I just wrote? And we'd be in bed just having had sex. And he'd say, can you email it to me?
Yeah.
And I just thought, so then, you know, when I started writing, it was only maybe 5 or 6 years later when all of a sudden people were just like dying for my words and sharing them. And I thought, I'm the same me. I just have people, more eyes on it now. And that's all you need. I just wanted one person. So if you don't even have that one person, which some people don't, find it. There is something called the internet. It can be the devil. It can also be the most amazing thing in the world. You can email me, dear listener, if you don't have it, and I will put you in touch with communities and groups and free, you know? So find it. There's people there.
Okay, great. Okay, the last thing before this last section, which is this was another thing. I didn't quite understand it, so I'm going to ask it. I thought how interesting it is where the mind goes when it's confronted with pain. One pain becomes all pain, and that pain builds upon all the other pain, and all of it becomes the same memory revisited in the body over and over again. And I thought, what does that mean? One pain becomes all pain. And why is that important?
Because, well, it's about empathy and for other people, but also, so the big trauma in my life and the pain that I swallowed and that really determined so much of who I am today was losing my dad in that traumatic way at age 8. So whenever things happen, that would come up. So whatever pain was in the moment, it would be again about my dad. And then each one, especially if I didn't process it or grieve it, it would then come up. So for example, I would have a really hard time going to funerals because I didn't cry for my dad and I shoved it all in. So I'd go to a funeral and it was like a dam would open up in me and I couldn't bear it because this pain then became my old pain and it all blended together. And I do believe that's what happens for a lot of us. So, you know, we all have our thing. For example, when I see father and daughter stuff, it makes me really emotional. I know my friend who's lost her 2 sons, she, for the rest of her life, things with mothers and sons or, you know, whatever it is. So there's something in us that our pain becomes every pain. We can recognize it. So it's, I don't know, pain is something every human being feels.
I see. Okay. So it's more, it's the feeling of pain.
Yes.
And that when we can recognize that instead of saying it's this pain, it's when my dad died, it's when this happened, that makes it separate from someone else's pain.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I should have added that line in, but next. Yes, exactly. But I mean, I have, you know, that line, it was actually going to be in a poem that kept coming to me because of the way I didn't deal with anything. And I really didn't. I just shoved it all down. When I would, for example, when my boyfriend left me when I was 21, when I was in NYU, I had a nervous breakdown. I wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself. Was it really about that? No. Looking back, absolutely not. It was about my dad. But one pain became all, it was just like this universal pain. And it, when something happens, it gets brought up. So there's that. And then there's what you said, which is we are not as separate as we think we are.
Right. But also what you just said too, it's like, if I can say to myself, oh, it's not my boyfriend necessarily my boyfriend breaking up with me that's destroying me. It's the pain of losing my father, or it's just the pain, then it doesn't have to become, I have to fix this. It's just, I need to be with the pain.
Yeah, you know what? Another gift from my 40s. That did not happen then. So, you know, and looking back, hindsight, beautiful gift of hindsight, I can see that now. Oh, that was really me grieving about that. That brought up me feeling abandoned and that people always leave. And, you know, in the moment, of course, it didn't feel like that. I just felt like, I'm going to die. Danny left me. Now I do, I don't know. I mean, I the next thing I go through, hopefully I will be able to go, okay, just be with this. This is just, this is not just about this. This is about all of it.
So to be, if I can be with this, if you can be with that, then I can sit in the room with the woman who just lost her baby. And I can, yeah, because it's just, it's pain. That's what it is. Yeah, that's beautiful. Okay. So before I go into the last question and the last part, is there anything, I mean, there's a ton that we haven't touched on, but is there anything in particular that you want to speak to?
No.
Okay.
You're doing great. You asked really awesome questions.
Thank you. Okay. So the last part is, first of all, I'm going to tell people where to go to learn more about you. And there's two places. One's jenniferpasteloff.com. So just her website. And then Instagram at Jen Pasteloff. And it's PASTILOFF. So those are great places. And it's just as Jen said, if you go there, you're going to get the truth. You're going to get your what's happening. It's honest. It's real. It's human. And then the next piece is a gratitude for you. And there's obviously many things I could be grateful for. And I want to speak to something. I think for me right now, what I'm most grateful for is this idea of the and, that you embody the and, living in this space of it's this and this. And you know what? That works because that's what it is to be human. So yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that. It's really a beautiful thing to say. I wish more people would find that earlier in their lives. So they have to feel that they fit into other people's timelines and boxes and shoulds. And
I have to find it every day, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hard one to remember. So then the last thing is, I have one last question. I think for you, you mentioned it already, but it's such a key piece of being human. And that is this epiphany that you had that no one else will give you a medal. You have to give yourself one. Just speak to this idea of yes, we may get an actual medal for certain things, but for the most part, we're going to go through life not getting medals for pretty much everything. So why that matters so
I don't know why it took me so long to realize it, but I finally did, thank God, or I'd be still probably waiting tables, waiting for someone to come in and discover me and put me in a movie. You know, because I spent my whole life waiting for someone to give me permission, waiting for someone to discover me. I was pretending to be an actress. I use the word pretending not to be an asshole, but really I wasn't doing anything about it. I just was flapping my jaw saying, I'm an actress, and I wasn't out there going for it, you know, just whining that it wasn't happening for me. And so I am waiting for someone to love me and make me feel better about myself, give me a book deal, all the things. And so, you know, in the book, I talk about this one woman who came to the retreat and didn't like it and left after a few days, and because it wasn't yoga enough for her and it was too feelingsy, too many feelings. And I felt really bad about myself. And it made me realize that I was telling the story to these women at the retreat who stayed, you know, and I basically wanted them to make me feel better, which is human and it's okay. And I love that, actually. My favorite words are, it's going to be okay. But in the moment of wanting that from them, of, you know, I was standing there like, I mean, look what I did. I'm deaf and I do this and I dropped out of college. And I realized that I wanted them to give me a medal. And that revelation happened standing in that kitchen. And it was an oh my God moment. Oh my God, this is not going to happen. how is it taking me until nearly 40 years old to realize no one's going to put a medal around my neck for keeping on going, for, you know, doing this work of listening when you can't hear very well, for, you know, having the courage to quit the restaurant, whatever it is, no one's going to give me a medal. I have to do it myself. That's why I said, yeah, when I walk in a room now, there, I can tell the way I feel about myself is contagious. People recognize that. They recognize that I don't hate myself anymore. And some people didn't know me before. So it's sort of like, this is all they've known. Now, I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not saying that I am, you know, the most confident person in the world, but I can say I walk in a room and I'm okay with who I am. I've got a medal for, and all the things.
And that is so beautiful. And it's such a perfect place to stop, because it's all about giving it your, you give yourself the medal. It comes from inside. You're creating all of this, you're sharing all of it. And it's just, it's perfect. So thank you so much, Jen. Thanks for being part of the podcast.
You're perfect. You have the best voice. You ask really great questions. It's organic. It's interesting and alive. It's just, it's by far one of the best I've done. You, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. It's working.
Thank you.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. For more conversations with brave and experimental artists and makers, and to learn more about the collective, head on over to thecreativityhabit.com. You can follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram at Daphne Cohn. And you can support the podcast and everyone who's on it by going to iTunes Podcasts and subscribing, rating, and reviewing this podcast. And thank you for listening.